from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll explain how different city departments work with local businesses to provide services to Milwaukee residents. Then, in Capital Notes, we'll learn how a state Supreme Court decision that upheld the governor's veto power could impact the state budget.
So the question becomes, can they reach some kind of deal on the budget? Is there some kind of way to protect the language from what the governor can do now with this kind of decision under his belt?
Plus, we'll speak with the author of a new book all about people with a Wisconsin connection who've changed the world.
I always had a strong interest in getting other people emotionally invested in these people, too. I always wanted my heroes to become your heroes, and the best way to do that is through storytelling.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. From asphalt to auditing, the city of Milwaukee relies on local businesses to fulfill its obligations to residents. But how does the procurement process work? And how can business owners get contracts with the city? Rhonda Kelsey is the purchasing director for the city of Milwaukee, overseeing the city's procurement. Her office is hosting a vendor fair on Thursday for local businesses to learn how to do business with the city. Ahead of that, Kelsey joins Lake Effect Sam Woods to talk about what businesses can learn at the fair, the types of goods and services the city obtains, and tips for winning a city contract. Kelsey begins by explaining the process.
City departments will submit a request, or what we call internally a requisition, to our department asking us to administer the purchasing or procurement process for the thing. So using the Department of Public Works as an example, the city's lead agency for, you know, maintaining the city's infrastructure, the roads, et cetera. So the department will make that initial request. Hey, purchasing division, we would like your department to issue a competitive bid solicitation for us to purchase asphalt, using that as an example. So we will compile the bid solicitation documents, advertise that request by pushing that out via eNotify, which is an automated email notification system that vendors can sign up for to receive a bid notice in their particular field or industry.
So you mentioned asphalt that DPW might, you know, knock on your door and request. But what are some examples of the types of services that city government typically contracts for?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, we are a local government agency with the primary focus of serving city residents. So when you think about the things that we procure, these are things that will support the delivery of services to city residents. So we're procuring lab equipment and supplies for the health department, right, to serve city residents at the health centers, vehicles for the police department, fire trucks for the fire department, water chemicals to keep the city's water supply clean. So really, we are procuring the things that city government needs to operate and function and render services to city residents. There are unique services that I think folks may be surprised about. For example, a few years ago, we actually executed several contracts for what I would call wellness or healing oriented types of contracts to serve folks that have been traumatized as a result of being impacted by violence in their communities. We also execute a number of different consulting service-oriented contracts, financial services, auditing. Obviously, living in a digital age, we execute, frankly, quite a few IT software-related contracts for city agencies to do the work that they're doing. So if you think about, you know, services that are rendered to city residents throughout the city, again, we're procuring the things that those departments need to function, right, to provide those services to city residents. Again, the water chemicals is a great example. We spend millions of dollars to keep the city's water supply clean and healthy for city residents. So you name it, we frankly, I feel like we buy it.
You've been in this role since 2008, and I can imagine in throughout that time, things like water chemicals, not to bring up asphalt again, but asphalt has always been something that the city has looked for contracts for. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine, you know, those wellness services that you were talking about, mm-hmm. that might be something that you weren't contracting for in 2008, but you are now. How have you seen the city of Milwaukee's, the services city of Milwaukee looks for change in your time as purchasing director?
That's a great question. In 2008, the Office of Community Wellness and Safety did not exist. And so as city government has morphed over the years, frankly, I think we've seen a shift in service delivery, hence the contracts that I mentioned that are focused on wellness and violence prevention in the community. I think another factor that impacts city purchasing and the things that we procure for city agencies, frankly, depends heavily on dollars that we receive from other governmental entities. So several years ago, the city of Milwaukee was awarded the federal American Rescue Plan grant, and that was millions of dollars that were awarded to the city to focus on the community. And so as we receive, you know, large grant dollars from other governmental entities, that also kind of impacts what we buy as a local agency. So, for example, you know, quite a bit of the funding that we received under that particular grant was focused on lead abatement in our communities. And so I think that is another major factor that impacts the things that we buy.
Well, I mean, that certainly makes sense. You know, you get a grant for lead abatement, you get a grant for public safety, something, a special event like the RNC, then yeah, of course, then your purchasing of those two things is going to go up that year because you have more money for it,
right.
Specifically for
absolutely.
It. So, you know, we've covered that the city contracts for a number of different services, but is there something that you typically look for in a business partner? Is there a through line where you can say, you know, this is something that we look for across services from a business? Like, I don't know, reliability, been working in the industry for 10 years or more, you know, something like that?
It does. That's a really good question. I mean, it really does depend on what we're procuring or what we're purchasing for city government. Pricing. Cost effectiveness,
sure.
As an entity that is responsible for, you know, responsibly managing city taxpayer dollars, cost is very, very important, frankly. Through our formal competitive bidding process, we're actually required to award contracts to the lowest complying bidder. That being said, pricing, frankly, is not always the primary factor. When we're utilizing a request for proposal process, which is more of an objective evaluation process as it relates to awarding a contract to a particular vendor, we are looking at other factors above and beyond just cost, right? We're looking at the experience of a particular contractor or business. We're looking at their methodology. We're also looking at the timeline. So absolutely, we're looking at those things, the number of years that they've been in business, who are their other clients or customers, as well as the performance that they've been able to provide to those other agencies through a reference check process. So it really does depend on, you know, what it is that we're buying and what method of procurement that we're utilizing to acquire the product or service for city agencies.
So I'm going to ask a question on behalf of business owners who might be listening to this. So does it cost anything to apply or submit a bid for city contracts?
Absolutely not. And I am so pleased to say that we do not have any fees or a vendor registration list that vendors have to pay for to do business with the city.
In that same vein, question for businesses who might be listening. Do you have any tips for businesses across sectors who are thinking about applying for city contracts?
Great question. Absolutely. First and foremost, if a vendor or contractor is interested in doing business with the city and they're in the process of submitting a bid to the city of Milwaukee, I know it sounds pretty rudimentary, if you will, but please read the details of the solicitation very carefully and make sure that you're following the instructions and the details in the bid solicitation document. And there's a reason for that, like, because we need to make sure that the process is transparent, that the process is fair, and that everybody is competing on the same level, being asked the same questions, submitting the information that we need to evaluate bidders from an apples to apples perspective. Mm-hmm. So first and foremost, I would say read the details. Number two, I would say take advantage of opportunities such as the city's upcoming vendor fair to network with city departments such as the purchasing division and other city agencies to learn more about the things that we purchase as a city government agency, and also to learn the processes and the procedures that are necessary to submit a bid and to do business with the city of Milwaukee. Third, I would say if you are a small business that is interested in doing business with the city of Milwaukee, I highly encourage you to contact the Small Business Enterprise Program, which is in the Department of Administration, and look into getting certified with the city of Milwaukee as an SBE firm, as a small business enterprise firm. It's a great way to get your foot in the door if you're a small business that's new to doing business with city government.
So earlier you mentioned the vendor fair coming up later this week. Can you tell me more about what the vendor fair is and what you're expecting?
Absolutely. And I am so excited to do so. So the vendor fair is actually coming up on April 24th. Mm-hmm. It will be held over at BMO Tower, downtown Milwaukee. And the focus of this particular event is to provide businesses that are interested in doing business with the city an opportunity to learn how to submit a bid, how to literally step by step go through that process and utilize the software platform that we utilize for vendors to submit bids with the city. It's also an opportunity for businesses that are interested in getting certified with the city to learn more about what the certification process requires and what they are required to submit in order to obtain that certification. The third focus of the event is to provide an opportunity for small businesses to network with city agencies to learn again more about the things that we procure as a first-class size city. We will be hosting several workshops on that day. And again, they will be focused on certification, not just with the city of Milwaukee, but we will also have representatives from Milwaukee County participating in that workshop. We will have workshops that are focused on mentorship and business expansion. I mentioned earlier a workshop focused on how to submit a bid, how to submit an RFP with the city of Milwaukee, as well as workshops that will be focused on securing business capital. And then lastly, a workshop that will be focused specifically on how to use the law to protect and grow your business. So we're really, really excited about the fair. This is our second annual fair. I encourage everybody to come on down.
That was Rhonda Kelsey, purchasing director for the City of Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods. You can find an extended version of their conversation, including tips for local small business certification, at WUWM.com.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Ayan Silver in conversation with J.R. Ross. He's editor of WizPolitics.com. Hi, J.R. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. So big news last week. The Wisconsin Supreme Court issued a decision on a case that's colloquially called the 400-year-old veto. Back in 2023, Democratic Governor Tony Evers used his really expansive veto pen to lock in school funding for 400 years by he basically took language that originally allowed for a $325 per student increase in K-12 public schools. It said it applied to the 2023-24 and 2024-2025 school years, and Evers vetoed the 20 and the hyphen to make the end date 2425, which is more than four centuries from now. That's a long synopsis, but what can you tell us about that decision, JR?
Well, one, there's a legal piece to it. What the court is saying is that governors have the power to strike out individual numbers in a budget. So back in 1990, voters approved this amendment to the Constitution that said governors can no longer strike out individual letters. They called it the Vanna White veto. The court said, look, that amendment didn't include language about digits or numerals, so you can't apply it to this, therefore this amendment is constitutional. Then there's the political and budget impact. Republican lawmakers have been saying for weeks they want to see this decision before taking up the budget. They want to know how expansive the governor's power is going to be because they're kind of worried or were worried that if there was going to be a decision from the court that upheld this veto, the governor might get more aggressive in how he kind of approaches language in the budget. Well, they have their decision, and now they're kind of fretting about, you know, their power being usurped, and Governor Evers has this expansive, even more expansive way to work the budget bill. So the question becomes, can they reach some kind of deal on the budget? Is there some kind of way to protect the language from what the governor can do now with this kind of decision under his belt? Like every budget I've covered for all these years, the last thing that lawmakers do is they have their kind of key policy wonks get in a room and look at this budget language and go, okay, where can we see a place the governor could use that veto authority? And they try and like veto proof it. It happens every 2 years. It's going to be tougher now to veto proof this budget because they can strike individual numbers, right? What do you do? And they got to think about that, how they draft this thing and how they send it to him, because there's fodder here for Evers to rework stuff to his liking with these kind of reinforced powers.
Yeah, so just a small civics lesson for people who might not know how the budget and how Evers' veto pen works. How does it work in a nutshell?
So back in 1930, voters approved a constitutional amendment that gave governors a partial veto authority. It allowed them to only use on appropriation bills to strike language, okay?
Appropriation means if there's funding involved in the bill?
If there's money in it. Now, there's a side story about another Supreme Court case out there about what that actually means, if it's just actually like has dollars in it or like says how to appropriate the money. But we'll say that for another day. The key thing here is starting in 1930, governors has power to go over any spending bill to use this authority. Voters have reined it in several times. There's a 1990 amendment that you can't strike out letters. Mid-2000s, there's an amendment called the Frankenstein veto. You can't take two different sentences and stitch them together, create a new one. You know, it's happened before, but it's a unique power among governors in this country. In fact, it's considered the strongest veto pen in the nation among governors who have it.
Interesting. And so the state Supreme Court, I mean, was implicated in this decision. Obviously, it was kind of the first big decision that came out since the election in early April. The justices split on party lines. Can you tell us anything? Was there any kind of insights that came out of their approach to this case?
Interesting that one, conservatives led by Brian Hagedorn, they ripped the majority decision. They've got a problem with it, that this is basically allowing the governor to write the law. supposed to be lawmakers write the law. The governor signs the laws and carries them out as executive branch. He's arguing that this is expanding that power of the governor, and he's getting now creeping more and more into the legislative authority. So that's kind of his argument against this. And that the courts, in Hagedorn's words, have basically blessed this expansion of power over the years, and they had a chance to write that, to write the ship, and they passed in doing that with this decision.
And I guess Justice Jill Karofsky wrote for the majority that the 400-year modification is, quote, attention-grabbing, but that, you know, the state constitution really doesn't limit the governor's partial veto power.
Yeah, and the majority opinion has, like, a number of recommendations to how to deal with this. You know, hey, lawmakers, you could change how you draft your bills, the budget bill going forward. You go back to constitutional amendment, that could be something you could do. It doesn't actually call for any of these things or endorse any of them, but it says, hey, here's some options. What's kind of noteworthy to people is that during the arguments back in October, Karofsky said, you know, does this go too far? You know, this 400 years is kind of mind-blowing to think about 400 years. This has gone too far. And her legal analysis, it did not.
You're tuned into Capital Notes. I'm WEWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. All right, so shifting gears a little bit, WizPolitics tracked $109 million in spending on the state Supreme Court race this April. Where did all that money go? Who benefits from that? I mean, is it remotely the people of Wisconsin or not at all?
Oh, TV stations made like bandits. Let's be honest, they did pretty well. But looking at the spending overall, about $59 million was spent by Brad Schimmel and those backing him, $50 million by Crawford, those supporting her. Now, a couple caveats. One, these are numbers I pulled together from looking at independent expenditure reports filed with the state. Those are express advocacy ads, you know, vote for, vote against, support, oppose, those magic words that trigger reporting. I also, we subscribe to Ad Impact at WizPolitics, which is an ad tracking service. And then I've got my sources with various groups who kind of help me with numbers. What I'm getting at is issue advocacy, like call J.R. Ross, tell him he stinks. Like, those aren't reported to anybody. It's hard to know exactly what was spent on those ad buys, and there are plenty of them. So my number of $109 million, probably light. Is it $10 million, $20 million? I don't know. Nobody can tell me for sure. But more was spent than I've tracked, all right? There's that. And two, a lot of money went to spent to on-the-ground organizing. Elon Musk and his pack, America Pack, spent like $12 million, if I remember it correctly, most of it on canvassing, doing doors, you know, text messages, like trying to get voters out. So you had all this money spent on the get out the vote effort, on ad buys, you know, whether it's digital, radio, TV, the overall efforts where it all went to. And, you know, there was a lot of money spent to try and drive turnout, and it worked. We got 2.35 million people voted in Wisconsin April 1st. That is impressive for a spring election without a presidential primary on the ballot. Yeah, it was amazing. Wisconsinites amaze me every election. When the spotlight is on Wisconsin, voters answer the bell every time and turn out in big numbers. It just so happened this one, though, that while Republicans got the number they were looking for, Democrats turned out in even bigger numbers more than anybody anticipated, and that's how you got the 10-point win.
So when it comes to money, basically average Wisconsinites, if they were involved in get out the vote efforts, they might have gotten a little bit of that bag.
Yeah.
But if
you
not,
know,
yeah.
If you're getting paid to do doors, I mean, it's not, you know, they have these groups that do stuff, but no, it's not flowing to voters like you and I like that, no. It's unless you got your $1 million from Elon Musk. Now, I haven't seen that reported anywhere yet, how they did that one. But so there are three people who he says he gave $1 million checks to, so somebody made out like a bandit this spring in Wisconsin, thanks
right.
to Elon Musk.
In addition to the TV stations and possibly yeah. the U.S. Postal Service with those yeah. all those mailers. Okay, well, I want to close, as long as we're still talking about elections, with the 2026, a look forward at the 2026 governor's race. Do we know yet if Evers is running for re-election? What's the latest on the potential GOP challengers? Is it Brett Favre? I'm joking about that.
So Evers hasn't said yet what he's going to do. He's told us he'll wait till after the budget. And this comes up in my calls like every week. Hey, is the governor going to run? And my answer hasn't changed on that probably a year. When I talk to people close to the governor, they tell me he likes the job. long as his health is doing okay, that his wife's health's doing okay, they think he'll probably run again. Now, there's also his chief of staff is Maggie Gao. There are some who think that if she wants to stick around and do this for four more years, that would be a big piece of the decision. But all signs are pointing to that he will likely run. Now, the caveat is, at the end of term number three, he'd be in his late 70s. You know, that's not exactly a young age to be doing this. So does he want to do this that much longer? There's that piece to it. Looking at the Republican field, there's nobody in yet, but lots of names percolating, and they have a lot to think about. Number one is, what can you take away from the spring election and apply it to November? I caution anybody to say, well, the Dems won by 10 points in April, therefore they're going to win by X points in November of 26. Doesn't work that way. However, there are signs of the electorate that people aren't happy about Donald Trump and his administration. There's energy among Democrats. Republicans who are happy about Donald Trump don't seem as motivated to go to the polls without Trump on the ballot. So there's something to think about. But as various candidates, potential candidates, kind of weigh their options, Bill Berrien is a businessman from southeastern Wisconsin. He formed a PAC last week that he said is going to help promote conservative causes and advocate for Republican candidates. It's basically campaign and waiting. I've seen these before with others. They get a team together. They start kind of make themselves well-known. Then they jump in. So he's making moves, at least, that make you think he's serious about running. Tom Tiffany, congressman from up in Minocqua, he's talking about it. State Senator Mary Feliskowski and State Senator Pat Teston. Teston's from Stevens Point. Feliskowski's up from the Tomahawk area up in northern Wisconsin. They're at least thinking about it. Josh Shulman, the Washington County executive, he's thinking about it. So there are lots of folks kicking the tires. Oh, and Eric Hovde. So Eric Hovde lost the Senate race, obviously, in 2024. Does he want to make a comeback, run for governor? Well, we don't know for sure. But lots of people are kicking the tires, and we're going to see that field start to coalesce. At some point, probably late summer, you'll start getting answers to people like they're in, they're out, or whatnot. And then away we go in the primary August of 2026.
And of course, we won't know what the big, super big issues will be at that point. But like you said, things are percolating. Thanks so much for these insights, JR. And thanks for joining me on Capital Notes.
Anytime.
You can hear Capital Notes every other Monday on Lake Effect. And just like Capital Notes, Lake Effect is a podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Two Milwaukee musicians have released an album that's a jazzy twist on the musical Fiddler on the Roof. We'll hear from them in about 15 minutes. But first, from musicians, activists, artists, and athletes, we'll learn about Wisconsin idols that have had an impact far outside the Badger State. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Georgia O'Keeffe, Chris Farley, Orson Welles, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. These might be local names you're familiar with. But how about the Beatles, Joni Mitchell, or Jackie Robinson? Wisconsin Idols, a new book by journalist and author Dean Robbins, explores intriguing true tales of legends and trailblazers, with special and even surprising connections to the Badger State. From the famous to the little known, Robbins hopes readers can appreciate how Wisconsin has been a crossroad for people who have changed the world. He'll be in Milwaukee this week for a book event, and ahead of that, he joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more about the book.
So how did Harry Houdini start your interest in collecting personal heroes, so to say? And like, what are some of the ways that you latch onto them in your life?
Well, ever since I was a little kid, I've been fascinated by certain heroic figures, people with extraordinary courage and vision and integrity. And Houdini was one of the very first ones. I saw an old movie on TV starring Tony Curtis when I was watching TV at my grandparents' house. And I was just stunned by this guy, Harry Houdini, who could break out of handcuffs and straitjackets and sealed crates. And I wanted to do that myself. So I would have my sister tie up my hands and my ankles with bandanas so that I could wriggle out of them the way that Houdini wriggled out of his straitjacket. And it was the start of a whole string of heroic figures that I would fall in love with one after the other. It was artists and athletes and activists and scientists. And I always had a strong interest in getting other people emotionally invested in these people too. I always wanted my heroes to become your heroes. And the best way to do that is through storytelling. So when I grew up, I became a journalist and a children's author, and now the author of Wisconsin Idols.
Yeah, you touched upon it a little bit, but I'm wondering a little more about what you think your career as a journalist and arts critic, how that kind of gave you a unique advantage for writing this book.
Well, as someone who's always loved heroes, I seek them out however I can. And as a journalist, I was able to interview them. I traveled the state of Wisconsin to look for often obscure places associated with these people. And in some cases, I even befriended them. So some of the people in the book are people that I actually know and have a sort of special insight into.
With this book, there's 100 people in here, but can you share the qualifiers you use to include them in the book? Because not all of them are necessarily Wisconsin natives. Some may have only spent even just a few hours here.
Yeah. Well, the first criterion was that I had to adore them. And then beyond that, of course, they had to have some connection to Wisconsin. So that includes people who lived here and who are associated with the state, people like Georgia O'Keeffe, Chris Farley, Oprah Winfrey. And then there were unexpected choices like the Beatles, Jackie Robinson, Joni Mitchell, Harrison Ford, people who had a significant experience while they were just passing through Wisconsin. Also, they had to be transformative figures. I didn't want this to just be a regional book. I wanted it to be about world-changing figures who had some connection to the state. And then finally, the last criterion was they had to have an interesting story that was little known and that I thought would be fun to tell and that would surprise and delight readers.
You also divide your book into categories that these idols fall under. There's melody makers, creators, scene stealers, champs, boundary breakers, and thinkers. And I imagine a lot of these kind of cross into multiple categories.
They do. And so those are not ironclad category boundaries. And I'm sure people will wonder why some are in one and not the other. But it was a good organizing principle. I'd originally just dumped 100 essays on my editor's desk, and she thought, how about we organize this in some way?
Sure, yeah. So let's get into some of these people and stories from Wisconsin Idols. And I want to start with Hattie McDaniel, which people may not assume or automatically think of.
Hattie McDaniel actually did live in Wisconsin for a couple of years. She was a singer. She was starring in the show Showboat. And she was touring through Milwaukee, and it was 1929. And while she was playing in Milwaukee in Showboat, the stock market crash happened, and she was out of a job. She had no money, so she was stranded in Milwaukee. And she got a job as an attendant at a ladies' washroom in a club called Sampix Suburban Inn in Milwaukee. And one night during the late show, they needed someone to go on stage because someone hadn't shown up. And the manager said, anybody here know how to sing? Well, Hattie was known as the old pep machine. That was her nickname. She had this kind of never say die spirit, and she was a radiant performer. She got on stage, she sang a knock 'em dead version of St. Louis Blues, and suddenly she was the star of the show. So she starred there for 2 years, and patrons would say, why are you still in Milwaukee? Why aren't you in Hollywood? And she started to think that same way herself, like, why don't I give it a try in Hollywood? So she had ended up in Milwaukee with $25 in her purse, and she made her way into show business. She starred in some movies, and she starred in Gone with the Wind as the Mammy character, which now looks like a condescending portrayal to us, but she brought so much personality and dignity to the role, and she won an Oscar for it and went on to try to elevate Black people in Hollywood in various movie, TV, and radio roles.
While we're talking about actors, and because I'm a Star Wars fan, we have to talk about Harrison Ford. And I feel like Star Wars nerds know about his local connection here, but can you share a bit more about Harrison Ford's connection to Wisconsin?
It is little known. So he was a student at Ripon College in the early 1960s. He was a terrible student. He slept through his classes. He was flunking out in his senior year. And in his last quarter, he knew he wasn't going to graduate. And he thought, what the heck? I'm going to try to get over my stage fright and take a theater class. So we start in a production of The Skin of Our Teeth in Rippon's Red Barn Theater. He was wearing a fake mustache and he loved it. And he thought, maybe I finally found my vocation. So to be sure, he signed up to do community theater that summer in Williams Bay, Wisconsin, at the Belfry Players Theater. And he was a little rough. He sometimes flubbed his lines, but he felt that he was maturing as an actor, and it gave him the confidence to head off to Hollywood and try his luck there.
Now, from sci-fi to an actual astronaut, can you share a bit about Apollo 13 astronaut Jim Lovell and his connection to Wisconsin and Milwaukee here in particular?
So I had a chance to interview Jim Lovell. He's one of the Wisconsin idols that I had a chance to talk to for the sake of the book. He was telling me the story of his experience on Apollo 13, which was a disastrous NASA mission. A tank exploded about 200,000 miles from Earth, and Lovell and his crewmates had to pull off one of the greatest recoveries in the annals of aviation. They used the lunar module as a kind of lifeboat and managed to make their way back to Earth. So I was interested in hearing the story and asking Lovell how he developed the extraordinary courage that allowed him to think fast and weather something like that without panicking. Well, he had his standard stories about the Apollo 13 mission, and that's what he wanted to talk about. He did not want to talk about why he was so courageous, which makes sense. He's a humble person. But I kept circling back to it, and it was not part of his normal story. But by the end of our interview, he said, well, I was the only child of a single mother in Milwaukee in the 1930s. She was always at work, and I was left home by myself. So I had to develop the quality of self-reliance. And I think that's where it all came from. And I don't think he'd ever revealed that before, or maybe even thought it to himself. So that felt like a journalistic coup.
Yeah, a pretty amazing experience, especially to talk to someone who has such a impactful moment of history. And shifting to some of music history that's here in Wisconsin, I'd love to talk about the Cordettes from Sheboygan. Now, if a lot of people are listening saying, who are they? Can you just start by saying what song they're best known for?
Mr. Sandman and Lollipop are their two biggest hits, but they had lots of other ones in the 50s and early 60s.
Mr. Sandman.
They were a vocal quartet from Sheboygan, four friends with these kind of lacquered Andrew Sisters hairstyles. And they sung Mr. Sandman, which became a huge hit down at the corner malt shop. It was just suffused with 1950s innocence. And right around when they recorded it, rock and roll started up and Elvis Presley came on the scene. And suddenly, clean cut vocal harmonies like that weren't so much in vogue anymore, but they changed with the times and they recorded their second huge hit called Lollipop, which got them on American Bandstand. It was a little bit edgier, but edginess was not really their thing. So they kind of lived and died with the 1950s when the Beatles came in and Bob Dylan came in. They were clearly sort of beyond their comfort zone. So they called it quits in 1964, but still one of the greatest things to ever come out of Sheboygan.
Absolutely. And people will definitely see Mr. Sandman in many a viral video with, multiple subjects in there. And as you said, while the Cordettes may not have lasted through the changes in pop genres, Joni Mitchell is an artist that stood the test of time. How did Madison have a role in her career?
Yeah, there's a wonderful Joni Mitchell story about Wisconsin. So she came to Madison in 1976 for a concert. She had just broken up with her boyfriend, and she called off the rest of her tour, which had been very troubled. She was staying at a hotel called the Edgewater Hotel, which was right on Lake Mendota, and a historic ice storm had just occurred. So the city was coated in ice. There was a sound of tinkling everywhere. It sounded like tinkling glass. And most of us would have just stayed in our hotel rooms and sunk into a depression, right? But Joni, the artist she was, she felt the call of the icy white void. So she put on a black skirt and a black ermine cape, and she went down to State Street in Madison and bought a pair of black men's hockey skates. She had a photographer with her. She jumped onto the frozen ice on Lake Mendota with the photographer following her, and she raised her arms out as if she were a bird in flight and just let the wind carry her across the ice while the photographer is snapping photos. It was just an uncanny scene. And it inspired the songs on her next mysterious album called Hajira. And she used the images that the photographer snapped on Lake Mendota on the album jacket, which Rolling Stone picked as one of the greatest of all time.
Now, given our time, we've only scratched the surface of the people included in your book, but this shows a bit of a range of topics. What do you feel is the importance of teaching people not only about the more famous figures they may have already heard about and their ties to Wisconsin, but also the lesser known idols of our state?
Well, I think we're in a time when we're really in need of heroic role models. We're so often confronted with the worst that people can be. I hope Wisconsin Idol shows us the best we can be. A friend of mine just read the book and said, I think courage is contagious. So hopefully people will read the book and be inspired by these stories of bravery and courage and integrity. And to me, the more people who model themselves after the likes of Jackie Robinson or Georgia O'Keeffe or Mildred Fish Harnack, who was a Nazi resistance fighter, the better off the world will be.
Well, Dean, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to share more about your book and the stories behind the idols included in it.
Thank you so much, Audrey.
Lollipop, lollipop, oh, lolly, 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 lollipop, lollipop, oh, lolly, 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 lollipop, lollipop, oh, lolly, 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 lollipop.
Boom, boom, boom. Dean Robbins is the author of Wisconsin Idols, 100 Heroes Who Changed the State, the World, and Me. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski ahead of his event at Boswell Book Company this Wednesday evening. You can find more information about it at WUWM.com. Two Milwaukee musicians recorded part of their new jazz album on a roof. We'll tell you why next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Two Milwaukee musicians recently released an album that's a jazzy twist on the musical Fiddler on the Roof. Some of the songs were recorded on the roof of a local synagogue. This Thursday, the musicians will perform at the Jazz Estate. WUWM's Mayan Silver talked about the project with vibraphonist Mitchell Shiner and cantor and flautist Jeremy Stein.
Earlier this year, I met with musicians Mitchell Shiner and Jeremy Stein to talk about their new Jazz Fiddler soundtrack. The first thing I asked them, after Shiner explained that he'd had a long day of touring, was if they had a hard out for the interview, which we started at about 4 p.m. Probably Mitchell's going to fade at some point.
I know, no.
9 p.m., I think. Hard stuff.
That's okay. Okay.
We'll go for 5 hours straight.
That's fine.
You.
That's great. We can watch the movie.
Yeah.
Right, that's only 3 hours.
Right.
Then we have 2 hours left.
Then we have 2 hours left.
All joking aside, Shiner then picked up the melodica and Stein grabbed the flute. They settled in for an impromptu jam of the soulful tune, Tradition. It's the opening number of Fiddler on the Roof, a musical about a Jewish milkman named Tevye. He's living in a Russian town called Anatevka in the early 1900s, navigating persecution, but also changing times. Tradition is also one of the tracks on their new album, On the Roof, Jazz Impressions of Fiddler, which they recorded in part in a studio and in part on the roof of the Beth Israel Ner Tamid Synagogue in Glendale, where Stein works as a cantor. The whole thing came about because Stein likes to go up on his synagogue roof and think. And one day, it dawned on him that he should play up there with Shiner and a whole band.
And I brought Mitch, the next time he was with me, I brought him up. I said, Mitch, I brought him out on the roof. I said, we're going to do a concert on the roof. And he looked at me.
You have a deadpan face.
Right. And I said, we're going to play jazz impressions of Fiddler on the Roof, on the roof. He said, that sounds crazy. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Then I said, followed up with, does your insurance allow for something like this?
Here's one of Stein's flute solos. Shiner calls him a jazzy chazan. Chazan is the Hebrew word for cantor.
Yeah, so that's the scale that I was playing, which goes very naturally with that music, is if you were in a klezmer environment, you would call it phrygish. If you were in a synagogue environment, you would call it a havaraba. It's the scale. And you get these notes. And
is that the fifth mode of harmonic minor?
It is more or less.
More thereabouts?
Yeah. And a lot of different cultures have that scale in it. But in a Jewish context.
Jews really dig it.
Yes.
Yeah. Something inside of me awakens with that sound, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Shiner notes that all cantors are fabulous singers, and many can play guitar and other instruments.
But I don't know too many cantors or chazans who can shred jazz flute. I mean, that is absolutely something so special and unique about Jeremy.
Shiner, who plays vibraphone on the album, gets out of the box in his solos as well, infusing them with a deep understanding of jazz and Latin jazz traditions and Jewish spirit.
I mean, a big part of the jazz tradition is the blues tradition, of course, and I tried to blend a little bit of that harmonic minor sound, but also throw in a lot of blues licks as well.
Fiddler on the Roof is well known for favorites like Tradition, To Life, and If I Were a Rich Man. Shiner and Stein's album has renditions of those, but also lesser-known tracks. Like this version of Do You Love Me, which is originally a duet between Tevye, the main character, and Golde, his wife, after he asks her if she loves him after 25 years of marriage. Shiner and Stein play it as a duet between flute and vibraphone. Here's Stein.
It was just this very back and forth conversation. And I thought, wouldn't it be funny if Mitch and I recreated that conversation, just the two of us? And that's that track I'm playing alto flute, which is a larger, lower version of the standard flute. And I thought that would be a nice way to embody Tevye, the baritone.
Proceeds from the rooftop concert where Shiner and Stein recorded some of the album went to organizations supporting housing advocacy in Milwaukee, like Pathfinders, Jewish Family Services, and Ovation Communities, Jewish Senior Living. So it's Fiddler on the Roof on a roof to support roofs.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
exactly.
Getting roofs over people's heads.
There is an album release show at the Jazz Estate this Thursday at 7 p.m. Tickets are on sale at estatemke.com. The album is also available for $18, with profits going to the Social Action Committee at Beth Israel Ner Tamid Synagogue and partner organizations supporting housing advocacy in Milwaukee. 18 symbolizes life in Jewish numerology, so I suppose you could say to life. To life, l'chaim. For Lake Effect, I'm Mayan Silver.
And that music wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, in our Earth Week series, we'll explore how climate change disproportionately affects Milwaukee's BIPOC community. Plus, we'll speak with the filmmakers behind the new documentary about Sally Ride that'll kick off the Milwaukee Film Festival this week. Thanks so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.